This is Seattle's Morning News. And for Dave Ross, I'm Aaron Granillo. And joining us now is CBS Senior Business Analyst Jill Schlesinger. Good morning, Jill.
Good morning.
Jill, I want to begin with more promising vaccine news. So Moderna released new results today confirming its vaccine does offer protection against COVID-19. Company will apply for emergency use in both the U.S. and Europe. What is the feeling among economists as to how quickly the economy recovers once people start getting vaccinated?
This is really the critical question that economists and investors are asking themselves, because we are going to have a time lag. The application, the announcement of these vaccines being available is fantastic news for all of us. However, we need the vaccine to be available to the majority of Americans. And we also need Americans to actually get vaccinated, because we know that there's this whole anti-vax movement and some people are really scared of getting vaccinated. So I when I talk to folks, they sort of say, well, you know, we're kind of looking through the second half of next year. That's where we're expecting there to be a big post-COVID bounce, that's the light at the end of the tunnel. There will be incremental progress once some people are actually vaccinated, but we won't get the real thrust of the benefit until the second half of next year. Now, that may seem weird, because if you look at the stock market, you might say, well, then why are we at record highs now? Because investors are looking beyond this pandemic. Economists are worried about what happens between this minute and when we are all getting vaccinated. And there could be a lot of economic damage done between now and that time, maybe 6-7 months from now.
Yeah, I mean, the stock market is one indicator, of course, but everyday people want to know, too. I mean, people who work in retail and restaurants, right? I mean, when is the feeling that those industries could ultimately recover, if they do?
Well, I think that that there will be a recovery. I think that there's going to be sort of this synergistic moment. It'll probably be in the late spring, where we are getting people vaccinated and the weather improves. And that gives people a lot of upside in some of those retail businesses that rely on physical interaction. Now, that means the winter could be pretty rough, though, right? And I think that we have to be very sober in our assessment of how much damage could actually be done between now and the late spring. How many more Americans could claim unemployment benefits? How many more Americans become food insecure? And again, I guess that this does actually rely on Congress to come through and say, we need to help those folks who are going to be negatively impacted, whether they are individuals or small businesses, and maybe even large businesses. You know, one area that I'm keeping a real close look at is states and municipalities. They could be the next source of layoffs as this COVID pandemic spike continues throughout the winter. And if they don't get support, if the states and the municipalities don't get support from the federal government, they're going to be forced to lay off even more people. So that's a real area of import right now.
I wonder what the projections are for the holiday shopping season. I know big retailers like, you know, the giants of Amazon are going to do just fine, but mom and pop businesses, how do they seem to fare this holiday season?
I think that that's a great question. I think that the small businesses that, you know, remember that I think about a decade ago, it was American Express that actually created Small Business Saturday, a focus on small businesses, are going to need our help as consumers. They're just not set up to do the same level of volume. And without that volume, it's very difficult. And, you know, I actually experienced this myself. I tried to go to my local bookstore to buy some books for the nieces and nephews. I went up to the front of the store. They had like a bench out front, and you couldn't go in the store because it's a very small little store, and they didn't have three of the five books that I wanted. And so then I said, well, how long? And they said, well, we don't know. And now you're faced with this moment. Like, okay, so should I get it from Amazon? Like, I want to support these guys. What should I do? So those are the choices that each of us is going to make. And the small businesses out there are going to really hope that we make the choice, which I made, which was I'll roll the dice and try to get the book from the local guys.
Yes, shop local. They need it. Thank you.
Yeah.
Let's shift now to the future Biden administration. President-elect expected to name his top economic advisors this week. Former Fed Chair Janet Yellen will be nominated as Treasury Secretary. What do we know about her economic philosophy and how it could shape the future of the country?
Well, it's widely known because she's a long history in government service. So she was the first woman who chaired the Council of Economic Advisers. She did that under President Clinton. She was the first woman to be the chair of the Federal Reserve. She did that under President Obama. And so now another first. Here's what we know about Janet Yellen in terms of the kinds of people. When I make phone calls to folks in Washington, D.C. or academics, I usually will say, well, what do you think about so-and-so? And they'll say, I like so-and-so, but, and there's usually a but. And what I can tell you is that if you make 25 calls about Janet Yellen, you cannot find a but. There's nobody on either side of the aisle who says, but she's blankety blank. So it's interesting. She's very widely thought of as a smart, diligent, well-prepared, consensus-building leader. And I think that that's probably something that's going to be very important for her. What's going to be also top on her list is how is she going to address this economic lag between now and the time of the vaccine? How can she broker a deal that is something that both Democrats and Republicans in the Senate can accept? She's been quite vocal in the last few months when she was in a think tank talking about how there must be more government support. So it's going to be incumbent on her to kind of herd all these different parties together and try to get to a place where we get dollars into the hands of the people who need it most.
I also want to ask you about charitable giving this time of year, because, of course, this is a season of giving. But didn't the CARES Act actually change the IRS rules for charitable giving this time around?
Yes, it was weird. It was kind of tucked in there. It was this weird benefit that's now getting quite a bit of play. And that is that inside of the CARES Act, there is a provision that says that any American who gives to a qualified charity can take a tax deduction of up to $300. And why is that so different? Because previously, you had to be one of the Americans who itemized their deductions. And you know, itemized meant only about 12 or 13% of Americans. Everyone else who claimed the standard deduction, you can give as much money as you want to charities, but there was no tax benefit. So now in 2020, each tax filing has the ability to take a $300 deduction of cash to a charitable that is legitimate, and you can go to the IRS website, irs.gov, to check out whether the charity's legitimate and qualifies for this. And that's a big game changer, and it's only for 2020 as a result of the CARES Act.
I know you also have some warnings about scams amid the COVID pandemic. What can you tell us about that?
It's just so demoralizing when I have to actually talk about this, but the IRS says that the pandemic, just like many natural disasters, gets the fraudsters out. So the big scam that's out there right now is a text message that goes to your mobile device and says, hey, Jill, you're entitled actually to a $1,200 stimulus check. We're the IRS. Send us your bank information. Now, an unsuspecting sort might get that and send bank information. However, that is a scam, and you should not respond to it. The IRS underscores they do not contact you via text or unsolicited emails. They don't call you threatening you. They don't call you demanding for payment on gift cards. It's really important that you have your guard up, because these pieces of information that get out to the fraudsters can be really a pain in the neck to clean up, and they can cost you money and, more importantly, time.
CBS senior business analyst Jill Schlesinger. Thank you for the time, Jill.
Great to be with you.
Seattle's Morning News, in for Dave Ross. I'm Aaron Granillo. As coronavirus cases continue to grow in Washington and across the country, all eyes are focused on what will happen a couple of weeks from now. Cover Radio's Hannah Scott explains.
While travel was nowhere near what it normally is over the Thanksgiving holiday, millions still took to the roads and the sky. And the warning on what we can likely expect because of this came from Dr. Anthony Fauci on NBC yesterday.
Unfortunately, as we go for the next couple of weeks into December, that we might see a surge superimposed upon that surge that we're already in. And, you know, and when I give that message, I don't want to frighten people, except to say, it is not too late at all for us to do something about this.
Here in Washington State, many stayed close to home, but it's not clear how many of us gathered outside of our households. Cairo 7 caught up with others returning to SeaTac who had traveled home for the holidays. This man knew it was risky, but wanted to ensure his parents stayed put in Indiana.
About my own safety, not so much. But when it came to like my parents and stuff, I recommended that they don't travel, and they didn't come to the Thanksgiving that we were having in Indiana.
He traveled despite the firsthand losses his family has experienced, with seven members of his family losing their lives to the coronavirus.
There's pros and cons to it. too much to consider.
But he plans to follow state guidance in quarantine, as does this woman, who just returned to Seattle from Texas.
I felt really safe on the flight. They wiped down everything. I had my sanitizer. I doubled up on masks when I was on the plane, so it was good for me, and I felt safe with everyone else.
That's state guidance to quarantine yourself for 14 days. Meantime, thousands of new coronavirus cases reported in Washington state over this holiday weekend, with the state health department admitting the backlog due to the mass increase in testing may have led to a duplicate count of about 550 cases. We expect updated numbers later today. For now, nearly 163,000 cases are being reported in the state since the start of the pandemic, including at least 6,000 new cases over the past few days. That also includes nearly 100 new hospitalizations in the state just yesterday. Meantime, the latest research from the Institute for Disease Metrics and Evaluation says more than 6,000 Washingtonians will likely die by March 1st from this COVID disease, based on their latest projections, but that 1,400 of those lives could be saved if 95% of us wore masks, a number we have yet to reach. Despite the warnings and a rise in cases, there continues to be a push for more kids to return to in-person learning. Seattle students are on remote plans until January as it stands, but the Seattle School Board expected to discuss the issue this afternoon in its 4 o'clock meeting. And as the nation gets ready to transition to a new administration at the White House, a local nurse has been named to President-elect Biden's Transition COVID-19 Advisory Board.
And Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott joins us live now. Hannah, speaking of students, I know you said the Seattle School Board would be meeting today, and I also heard Dr. Fauci over the weekend saying that it would be okay for kids to get back to school, because we now know the research shows that schools are not really the main driver of community spread.
Exactly. And that's been the chatter kind of for the last several weeks. You know, how do you balance the need for especially younger students to be in school for that in-person learning? And when some of the places that have done this, there hasn't been these really significant outbreaks. That said, some of our local health officials have said if you were to, you know, do that across the board all over the state, even just with your elementary school students, what happens in community is going to likely translate eventually into what happens in school. So you have to be able to have the testing for both students and staff and have the contact tracing in place to really be able to do that. And that's the pushback that you're getting from the WEA, the state teachers union, essentially. They don't want it teachers returning back to school until this is under control, the virus. So we'll see what happens. Again, Seattle, we'll talk about this, though, at 4 today.
So for people who traveled for Thanksgiving, the recommendations now, I heard from White House coronavirus coordinator Dr. Deborah Birx, she says to assume you are infected and to get tested. Is that what our state is recommending people around here to do?
And they're saying for you in our state, the guidance is to stay home for 14 days. And that's in line with, you know, assuming that you have been infected with this. Because of the massive increase in testing, I've not heard anyone specifically say to go and get tested if you went and traveled. They had some concerns. That's part of the reason we had such a big uptick before the holiday was a lot of people went out and started getting tests so they could travel, right? Because we also had that quarantine in place before you travel kind of a thing going on. It's guidance. So I think that they're really overwhelmed testing wise. You would be better to just 14-day quarantine. And I believe actually that guidance on the national level is expected to change this week, with the CDC expected to recommend 7-day quarantines with a negative test. So I don't know how that will translate in our state with our testing abilities.
We know infections lag, cases lag by about a week or so after like these major holidays. We've seen it over 4th of July, Memorial Day, all these big holidays. So we probably won't know the full impact of Thanksgiving until next week, perhaps. Are you hearing, though, that we are prepared for a surge of new cases? I mean, are hospitals ready with PPE, staffing, all of that?
Look, staffing is already an issue at the hospitals, and it has been. And we are as ready as we can be. There is really, really serious concern, though, that this next surge of cases, if too many people are infected because of the Thanksgiving holiday travel, and then again, there were people at the airport yesterday saying, yeah, they intend to do the same thing over the Christmas holiday. Fortunately, most of them said they were in quarantine. But if you see this huge surge in cases beyond, as Fauci said, a surge on top of a surge kind of thing, that would overwhelm our hospitals in the state, and that would be very significant. And not just the state, very likely the nation.
Cover Radio's Hannah Scott. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
That means it's time for your daily dose of kindness. It's sponsored by Mike Novak and listwithnovak.com. For one little girl in Arkansas, this is already the best Christmas ever. CBS's Steve Hartman with her hard-fought battle for equality in the field of plastic toys.
It's already the best Christmas ever for 7-year-old Vivian Lord of Little Rock, Arkansas.
Look at this!
But why such glee?
So excited.
Over plastic toy soldiers. To understand, you have to go back to the summer of 2019.
I'm coming in for another shot.
It was during one of her brother's air raids that Vivian was struck. Struck by the fact that her army men were all just that. Men.
I noticed that there were no girl army men.
No girls.
They don't make them.
My interview from last year.
And were you disappointed when you found out there weren't any?
I don't know why anybody has not thought of that.
So Vivian wrote a letter that read in part, "Please, can you make army girls that look like women?" She sent copies to several army men manufacturers, including Jeff Immel, owner of BMC Toys in Scranton, Pennsylvania.
I've never gotten a letter from a child like that before, but every now and then somebody asks, do you have any female toy soldiers?
The answer has always been no, although Jeff told me it was on a list of potential future projects. He even had concept drawings.
They were doing sketches, but they were busy making boy army men.
Vivian just couldn't understand the injustice. And when poor Jeff was faced with those puppy dog eyes,
so
he surrendered.
I'm going to do it.
You're going to do it.
I'm going to do it.
So Vivian put this to the top of the list.
Yeah, she put it to the top of the list easily. Yeah.
Shortly after receiving Vivian's letter, Jeff enlisted the first woman into the vintage plastic military. Today, there are 22 figures in all. And this holiday, they will be taking up positions under Christmas trees across the country.
And that makes me super happy. I would play with them every day.
Every day.
A decisive victory in the battle for equality. Steve Hartman on the road in Little Rock, Arkansas.
And right after listening to this, earlier this morning, I got online to that toy store and ordered a couple of sets for my daughter and also for my niece, because her mother, my sister, is an Army veteran. So she should definitely have female soldiers to play with. I think no better use of your money, $14 for representation. And I also consider it a small business, right?
Yeah.
So Cyber Monday, small business shopping. I did my part. Now you have to pre-order. I don't know if I'm going to get them by Christmas, but anyways, this story really spoke to me. I think that's awesome. Yeah. 7-year-old just changed the landscape.
Mission accomplished.
Yeah.
And now the G and Ursula Show, weekdays 9 to noon here on Cairo Radio. It is G Scott and G Monday Night Football. The Seahawks tend to shine at night, especially against bad teams like the Philadelphia Eagles. We got this win in the bag, right, G?
It's still got to be played there,
okay.
AG. Okay. Come on, man. It's still got to be played. I mean, on paper, yes, the Seahawks should win this game. But there is something that is kind of making me nervous. Now, the Eagles have been bad this year, and I think that they've been bad because of their quarterback, Carson Wentz. He's the quarterback that they paid money to. So you know how that is. If they paid the money, you got to play. However, last week, Jalen Hurts, the quarterback out of Oklahoma, who was drafted by the Eagles, was getting first-team reps. All I'm saying is this. I think that Jalen Hurts needs to wait At least he doesn't need to play in this game. He does not need to play against the Seahawks. Let Carson Wentz get out there, do his thing. I'm sure the Seahawks have prepared for Carson Wentz. So I think the Seahawks need to play against that, and they need to go ahead and get that win. But besides that, I just want to say, guys, it was a great weekend for the Seahawks. The Rams lost.
Yep.
Beautiful.
They had to root for the 49ers, though. That was kind of weird.
It was, but sometimes you got to do what you got to do. Yeah. And then you had the Arizona Cardinals. They lost. So this is beautiful news. Seahawks sit right there, Purdy, up in front at first place. Go ahead, win tonight, and really seal the deal.
The Broncos.
Oh, Colleen, I was waiting for like, okay, it's injuries. You hit me with the Broncos.
Yeah.
What? It's 2020, Colleen. It's 2020.
I know.
It's 2020.
I know. They were caught not wearing masks, looking at game footage. Quarterbacks were out, and so they went to the next best thing, I guess. But a lot of the players complaining today that NFL should have moved the game, that they're being made an example to the rest of the NFL. Do you agree?
Here's where I disagree with that. If everyone knows the history of the NFL, you know that the NFL does not cancel games. They don't want to cancel games. It is always, Colleen, been about money. 9/11 happened, game. No matter what. I remember when the Kansas City Chiefs, I think this was like almost 10 years ago, they had a player, guys. They had a player show up to the facility. He had harmed his wife before he got to the facility, and then came to the facility and then shot himself at the facility in the parking lot, and they still played the next game. So, Colleen, the NFL is going to play. This is week 12 right here?
Yep.
We're going through a global pandemic. They want to make, I take it back. I don't want to say they want to make their money. That'd be wrong for me to say. They want to play their games. How about that?
So did the Broncos make the right choice in who they chose to play quarterback?
Practice squad wide receiver.
Okay. But I will say, though,
poor guy.
That wasn't the most surprising thing about the Broncos. I mean, look, poor guy. I agree with you, Colleen. Poor guy. But what was surprising is that the Broncos really asked the NFL if they could have maybe one of their quality control coaches and maybe one of their assistant coaches play. Like, dude, this is the NFL. Are you being serious right now?
How do you think that made the wide receiver feel, that they would rather go with a coach than one of their players?
So, I mean, look, you know, if there's one thing, 2020, no matter how this year is going for you, if there's one thing we can all agree on, at this point, nothing shocks us. There's nothing, everything that happens right there, you're like, well, I can see that happening. There's nothing that's going to shock. I would not be surprised if they ask somebody's, if I don't be surprised if we don't see a 15-year-old playing because something happened, but they still had to play the game. I mean, it's 2020.
Yeah,
that's true. And this is going to show up as a trivia question one day. So just remember this. The Broncos went to a wide receiver when the coronavirus put all of their quarterbacks into quarantine.
I was going to say, poor guy, not to beat a dead horse, no pun intended, but the guy was, the Broncos QB, was 1-for-9 with 2 interceptions. We'll end it on that.
Wait, hold on. You mean to tell me that you guys are going to let me get off and not talk about Marshawn Lynch?
We're out of time. You talking about his locker room ritual?
Hey, we got to talk about that tomorrow.
Let's talk about that tomorrow.
All right.
In the meantime, you can catch G from 9 to noon on Cairo Radio. All right. In for Dave Ross on Seattle's Morning News, I'm Aaron Granillo. Thanks for joining us. Most of the local debate over police reform has centered on Seattle. This afternoon, the city's former police chief, Carmen Best, joined state lawmakers as they discuss likely proposals at the state level. Hannah Scott reports.
House Public Safety Committee Chair Roger Goodman, who led efforts in the legislature on I-940, has been working for months on a variety of proposals, along with Senate counterparts and reform advocates.
The group that worked with us during Initiative 940 related to the police use of deadly force has grown and evolved, and now they call themselves the Washington Coalition for Police Accountability. And they've been very well organized and working closely with us on this legislative package.
And there's been an enormous amount of work done.
There was a flurry of legislative proposals at the beginning, almost 60 ideas, and we've whittled them down to about a dozen or so very important bills related to questionable police tactics and excessive use of force that we want to bring under control, and also to strengthen accountability for officers who engage in misconduct, patterns of misconduct, or individual incidents of egregious misconduct. We also want to create more transparency to the public so that police activity is more known.
Initially, the plan was to create a database for use of force incidents to include who the officer involved was, who the civilians were, and what the circumstances surrounding the incident were. But it's since grown into something more.
Now we realize that there's software available to track lots of police activity, not just uses of force, but stops and searches and arrests, to see patterns there as well. And the police agencies are actually supportive of this because they can use this data to adjust their practices.
They're hoping Washington State University, a research institution, will be the custodian of this database so the data related to police activity can be readily analyzed.
This is not for punitive purposes, it's for analytical purposes. What we found in other parts of the country when these databases are set up, when law enforcement know that if they engage in misconduct, it's going to become public, their behavior changes.
There will be one very large bill that's still being finalized.
To create a stronger state-level accountability and oversight function at the Criminal Justice Training Commission. This is where law enforcement get their basic law enforcement academy training and ongoing training. But we want to expand the Criminal Justice Training Commission to be also a disciplinary body to hold accountable those officers who otherwise might be able to move from department to department and show troubling patterns of misconduct.
Because of the way the current state law is written, officers can appeal disciplinary decisions, and that can take months or even years to run the process out. Then eventually, should they realize they're about to be fired, they can jump ship early and just go work at another department in the state, with that disciplinary review essentially vanishing. This new proposal takes on what's known as the decertification process and is the backbone to all of the police accountability proposals. Here's why.
Let's say a nurse at a hospital engages in what might be malpractice. Let's say a patient dies because of the nurse's misconduct. The nurse is then fired by the hospital, but the nurse, through her union, is able to negotiate getting rehired. Meanwhile, the nursing commission on the state level takes her license away. So it doesn't matter whether she's rehired at the hospital. She can't be a nurse anymore. Similarly, we want to establish that type of structure for law enforcement on the state level, that if an officer is able to renegotiate getting rehired after having been fired for misconduct on the state level, that officer will be decertified, basically the license taken away. So if the officer's rehired at the police department, not going to be carrying a gun and a badge, going to have a desk job.
This proposal also expands the decertification process so that use of force is not the only issue that can trigger the review process.
There's going to be a range of misconduct that the Criminal Justice Training Commission looks at, not just use of force resulting in death or serious injury, but sexual misconduct, violations of constitutional rights of citizens. The most serious misconduct will result in mandatory decertification or removal of the license. And then there'll be another category of discretionary measures the commission can take. And a system of graduated sanctions, suspensions and probation periods and that sort of thing.
Goodman makes clear that he believes the vast majority of officers are good and decent people doing this very difficult job well. But
there have been too many incidents of egregious misconduct or patterns of misconduct that have not been held accountable. They don't have accountability in the end. It doesn't matter.
One of the big things Mayor Jenny Durkan has pushed is reforming the collective bargaining process, specifically with police unions, often seen as a barrier to reforms.
There will be proposals to look at collective bargaining agreements. It is very controversial because collective bargaining is a key institution in our economy. And there's a lot of sentiment not to erode collective bargaining rights in general, even if we may just only be looking at the police area right now.
So if a bill to deal with collective bargaining does not move, Goodman believes that decertification process would ultimately make the stronger accountability measure anyway. Still, many will point to that one particular aspect of collective bargaining that is seen as the true killer of all police accountability efforts.
The one aspect of collective bargaining that has really been troublesome is arbitration. And where an officer is fired and then through the arbitration clause in the police union contract is able to get rehired. And one of the issues is not the arbitration clause of the contract so much, but the arbitrators themselves. There's sort of a private arbitration industry out there. And they serve both sides, the police unions as well as the employers. But there needs to be more regulation of the arbitrators themselves. And so there's one idea that is becoming more popular, and that is to create a state-level regulated body of arbitrators. They've just done this in Oregon and in Minnesota recently, so that the arbitrators are more regulated, their compensation is set, they serve staggered terms. They can't sort of pick and choose what cases they take. So that may actually solve a lot of the problems.
Another proposal will take on the issue of police tactics.
Should law enforcement be engaging in questionable tactics? We are looking at a whole range of questionable tactics, including chokeholds, including the use of tear gas and other chemical irritants, the no-knock warrants where law enforcement is allowed to break down the door without even announcing themselves. High-speed chases through communities, shooting at moving vehicles, the use of military weapons and military vehicles. There's a lot of questionable tactics out there, and we have come to agreement between the community groups and the law enforcement groups about the need to restrain or limit or ban.
Car Radio's Hannah Scott reporting. Hannah joins us live now. So, Hannah, how much support do these proposals have right now in the legislature?
Certainly a lot of wide support among the Democrats. So this has been a project that largely has been run by Democrats in between the session over the summer. There's been some discussion with Republicans. I've been told by some, though, who are leading these efforts that pretty much everyone across the board understands there's going to need to be some level of police reform. And it's one of the top priorities. And next to the budget and dealing with the coronavirus, as far as the legislative session goes, this is right up there among the top issues. So I think you'll definitely see at least some of these go through. Tactics is probably the one I would give the best chance to go through in the first part of the session. Remains to be seen, though.
Yeah, and as far as those tactics go, so the state would decide how city police departments essentially operate, yes?
Yeah, as far as those tactics go. So, and that could be, like you said, there's not agreement yet necessarily on whether to ban altogether certain tactics or just limit them. The no-knock warrants thing is a big issue they want to get on the books. It's not something that happens very often in this state. It's the issue that led to the death of Breonna Taylor, which was one of the names we heard of police victims over the summer and all of the protests. So I think you'll see a lot of attention there. Another big thing is this change at the Criminal Justice Training Commission, which currently does review that decertification process as it exists, which rarely leads to an officer, if ever, being decertified. But right now, that's a law enforcement heavy board that reviews that. This would switch that and make it more civilian heavy as far as the votes to deciding this in this new system, that state accountability system that's going to be the key to really getting to legitimate police reform.
Anna Scott, thank you.
You bet.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. We're happy you're here.
And you can keep up with the show and find some of the stories from today online at MyNorthWest.com.